I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Heart and Circ. Today, we're talking with Kara Goss. That's right, another Kara. As I always say, the more Kara, the better the podcast. Just kidding. Kara Goss has published 3 papers in AJP Heart and Circ from 2019 to 2021. And the paper we're going to focus on today was published in May 2021 on sildenafil administration improves right ventricular function on 4D flow MRI in young adults born premature. When I pitched the idea to chat with us for this episode of Behind the Bench, Kara told me how she was inspired by her training in med peds and, in particular, her experience during a clinical rotation in the NICU. Kara ultimately followed a different clinical path into adult critical cardiopulmonary care, and it was ultimately a single encounter with a patient in acute cardiopulmonary distress who had, as Kara uncovered, a premature birth history. That birth history factored heavily into the course of treatment for Kara's patient. And it was that intriguing patient experience that led Kara to her research in extreme premature birth and increased risk of cardiovascular disease later in life. Now, as a mom of 2 boys, both of whom were born prematurely, Kara's work admittedly intrigued me too. And so I think we should dig a little deeper. Liz?
As Kara said, for many of us mothers, this will hit close to home, or we will know someone in the family that was premature. In my case, it was my husband. And I'm pretty sure if everyone just thinks for a second, they will know someone to whom this has happened. So it will be a very interesting podcast. However, before we dig into that, I want to ask Kara to define for us what is extreme preterm birth.
Hi, thank you all for having me on the podcast today. And I'm really excited to get to talk to you about our work. So when we talk about preterm birth, we're actually referring to anyone born less than 37 weeks gestation. And that gets further divided into categories to represent the degree of prematurity or the severity of prematurity. And it's really our most preterm babies that are at highest risk for both short and long-term complications, those being the babies who are born extremely preterm or less than 28 weeks. So that is essentially our highest risk group.
So I would imagine that depending of how earlier the baby was born, there are things that you check for.
When I evaluate now adults who are born preterm, you really have to sort of look back at their neonatal history and their neonatal course and ask questions to try to understand what sort of frame developmentally you should understand their current state in. What I mean by that is there's a difference between being born 23 weeks versus 30 weeks versus 36 weeks. And then even for any given 32-weeker, let's say, one 32-weeker may require being on a ventilator for breathing support during their NICU stay, while another 32-weeker may only need oxygen briefly and do great. So the neonatal course can be quite variable, and it's important as you're thinking about the long-term outcomes to really understand what that neonatal course was like. I do have a clinic, a heart-lung clinic specifically for adults born preterm. And when I see individuals in that clinic, oftentimes they're accompanied by a parent, sometimes mom, but usually someone who can remember what that NICU stay was like. You know, it may have been 20 or 30 years ago, but they still can tell me critical things about that NICU stay, like they were on a ventilator, how many days or how many weeks they were in the hospital. And because I have experience in med peds and taking care of these babies in the NICU when I was a resident, I can sort of reverse interpret and reverse translate the things that the patients or their parents are telling me about their course and sort of understand what diseases they may have had as a baby, and then can sort of extrapolate developmentally what that sets them up for higher risk as an adult.
That's great. I was just thinking, wouldn't it be fantastic if we had a centralized medical history system that, you know, it would be easy for you to access all this data. Of course, as you said, the moms will remember or someone from the family, but if you could go back and check all the charts and things like that, it will be very useful.
Fortunately, a lot of countries do have that sort of access. Most of the European countries do, which is why most of our long-term research actually comes from countries that have these centralized records like this, because those countries are able to identify and recruit these, you know, former preemie babies back for long-term follow-up studies. Unfortunately, we don't have that sort of medical record access here in the United States. So we're dependent on, you know, different strategies to identify potential participants for our research studies. This study was conducted while I was at the University of Wisconsin, and we had a cohort that was initially enrolled and followed in 1988 to 1991. And we used that cohort primarily to recruit for this study and some of the other studies we conducted there. I've since moved to the UT Southwestern in Dallas, Texas, and we also have a neonatal database here in Dallas that we're now using for ongoing follow-up studies. So there are ways to do it here in the U.S., but I think you have to be much more creative about how you can identify patients for research studies specifically. Now, obviously, that's totally different for people who want to come see me in clinic, because then I'm going to, you know, see them in clinic regardless of whether or not I can get neonatal records for them and, you know, have the best records that we would love to have. I'm still going to see people in clinic, obviously.
And Kara, when you're selecting your participants from young adults born premature, I was wondering, does it matter why they were born premature? So we've covered preeclampsia on this podcast, and I've done some preeclampsia research. Do you take that into account? Is a baby born, you know, at 34 weeks because the mother had preeclampsia? Does that adult or that baby look different from a baby born at 34 weeks for a different reason?
The short answer to that is yes, absolutely. The longer, more complex answer to that is we would love to take it into account much more than we already do, simply because we have relatively small numbers enrolled in our studies. We end up with, you know, just a handful of individuals who are born to preeclamptic mothers, for example. But we know from preclinical studies, as well as some of the larger epidemiologic studies from other countries, that there is a suggestion that preeclampsia, eclampsia, for example, has an impact on the vasculature, including the pulmonary vasculature, for the lifetime. So we would love to be able to look at that in much greater detail, but to do that, we have to have a much larger sample size. But I think this is a big challenge of doing this sort of research. And this is why, in my mind, I think we're behind the ball here on understanding what these long-term complications could look like for individuals who are born preterm. There just are very few databases or cohorts within the United States to be able to recruit from. Because of that, our team has tried to be very creative in recruiting. So one of our studies at the University of Wisconsin, we opened it up to anyone who was born preterm, as long as we could verify essentially a minimum set of data points about them. So we had to be able to verify their gestational age fell within our target and a few other things. It was pretty minimal though. So when we go to that sort of minimal data collection about their neonatal history, we lose out oftentimes on the ability to collect more detailed things like, did mom have eclampsia, preeclampsia? So you can see here, there becomes a significant balancing act that we have to do as investigators to decide what's most important. Is it most important to get preterm subjects enrolled in a study and get a larger sample size and the numbers that we need recruited? Or do we really need the detailed birth history? I'm hopeful with the database that we're using here at UT Southwestern now that we'll be able to accomplish both. The current database contains about 9,000 individuals, children and adults, who were born preterm at less than 32 weeks or so. So fairly preterm group, and we're recruiting those individuals now. For the most part, I found that individuals who are born preterm recognize that they're sort of the first of their kind, particularly those who are less than 32 weeks, and are potentially more likely to want to participate in research than the average person their age. And what I mean by that is before the 1980s, it was rare for individuals born at less than 32 weeks to survive for any great length of time. But now, in the 1980s, 90s, and beyond, the gestational age at which you can survive has become lower and lower and lower. We now see gestational age down to 22 weeks being survivable in particularly academic medical centers. That's not to say that everyone survives at 22 weeks, but that's a cutoff where we can have hope for survival. And obviously those 22, 23, 24 week survival is great, but it also comes with some increased risk and increased worry about the potential for both short and long-term complications. So people who do survive, they know that they're unique, they know they're special, but when they want to know what life's going to look like in 20 years after surviving this extreme prematurity, we oftentimes don't have great answers for that beyond, really about the age of 40 right now. So we don't know what life looks like at 50 or 60 yet for these individuals.
So Kara, when I was reading your manuscript, I found it fascinating. In the introduction, you were explaining that in individuals born premature, you see right ventricular, but not left ventricular dysfunction. And that right ventricular dysfunction is what you were getting at in this manuscript. And before we sort of get into your findings, what I wanted to ask is, why is that? I wrote, my notes say, what's up with that? And then I started hypothesizing on the Metro Inn today, and I realized that the right ventricle is going to the pulmonary circulation. And I had a real epiphany that babies are not breathing in the uterus. I have never been pregnant, which is why this took a hot minute to come to me. So is that why that they use their left ventricle a lot more in utero than the right ventricle? Or what's the deal with dysfunction on the right side, not the left?
So it's actually the exact opposite. And this is what's really cool about, so close. But this is why we have hypotheses, right? So it's actually the exact opposite in that in the fetus, so baby in utero, the right ventricle, the right side of the heart, is actually what we consider the systemic ventricle. What that means is the right side chambers of the heart are pumping to the body. And actually, because of the way blood flow is sort of configured, because of some holes and connections that exist in the fetus that close after birth, very little blood flow, less than 20% of the cardiac output, actually goes to the lungs in the fetus. And so all that blood flow that comes through the right side of the heart actually gets pumped out to the body and makes that loop. And much of that blood flow just bypasses, essentially sort of skips the left ventricle because of some fetal connections that exist.
I wish you could see my face now, Kara, because my jaw is on the floor. I cannot believe what I'm hearing. This is so amazing.
So then when this baby is born, and this is any baby being born, whether they're born at term or preterm, whatever, the change in oxygen, both going to a normal environment that we all live in, is an increase relative to what the baby was experiencing in utero. So in utero is a relatively hypoxic or low oxygen environment. Baby is born, and now room air normal environment is actually high oxygen relative to where they came from. And it's that shift, that change in the oxygen tension or oxygen level that causes the pulmonary vasculature to all of a sudden dilate and relax, and those sort of fetal connections and shunts to close. So now you have closing of these fetal connections and lowering blood pressure in the lungs, which under normal circumstances in older children and adults is about a fifth of what the body blood pressure is. So now all of a sudden, instead of the right ventricle blood flow bypassing the lungs, it goes through the lungs for the first time. And the right ventricle that in fetal life was the systemic and the stronger ventricle actually has way more remodeling to do. And it goes from being a ventricle that's just as thick and just as strong as the left ventricle on the left side of the heart to now very, very thin-walled, compliant, can take just as much volume, but very low pressures. And this transition happens over the first few days of life. The remodeling in the right side of the heart happens, takes more time, but the transition in blood flow and the pulmonary pressures happens within hours of birth. So why is it that the RV is more affected and the preterm baby? I think there are lots of potential reasons. We've done a lot of work in preclinical or animal models to look specifically at the RV, but I'll be honest, we have not done head-to-head comparisons, which we should and we need to do, of what the RV looks like relative to the LV to really understand why they're different. However, the amount of hemodynamic change and remodeling that is happening in the RV, first of all, is much, 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 much more than what's going on in the LV. The LV just stays the LV. It doesn't actually have to change and remodel much at all during all of this. In addition, in a preterm baby, they're more likely to be on a ventilator, which is gonna have effects on the pulmonary blood vessels and the vasculature. They're more likely to get treated with oxygen. They, you know, may have some areas of atelectasis or areas of the lungs that are not fully opening. And so the blood vessels are not functioning normally in that area of the lung. And now I'm taking all the things in the pulmonary vessels that should have been happening normally in those pulmonary pressures lowering to a 1/5 of what the body blood pressures are. And maybe they didn't lower as far as they were supposed to. Maybe they went to half of where they should have been. And now that right side of the heart is having to pump against higher pressures and other things that it would not have had to do normally if this baby was born at term.
My mind is blown. I'm gonna tell everyone this whole right ventricle, left ventricle thing that I see today. This is my fun fact of the day. Mic drop on this podcast. That was amazing.
Glad to do your fetal physiology lecture for the morning.
It's amazing. It doesn't matter how long we are on research. I love it when we learn new things every day. One of the questions I wanted to ask is, because this is such a hard thing to study in humans, how easy is this to study at the bench? Are there animal models that mimic this condition?
Yes, there are animal models. There are several different options. For small animal models, a number of labs use a mouse or rat rodent model. What we have been using for studying the heart is very similar to what has been used for decades now to study the lungs and pulmonary vasculature in bronchopulmonary dysplasia. What we do for rats is to expose the pups on the day of birth to hyperoxia or a high oxygen content. The rat pups go into a relative hyperoxic environment. And then we generally leave them in that in those hyperoxia chambers for 2 weeks and then have studied them at various time points, anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks of age all the way out to a year.
I was looking at the images in your manuscript and oh my gosh, they are stunning. You know, no wonder you made the cover of the journal. They were beautiful, beautiful images. Can you just give us a summary of the trial and the results you had?
Sure, I would love to. For this study, we enrolled 9 individuals who were born preterm. They came in for 2 separate study visits. And on each of the study visits, we tested a single drug with acute administration. So we did 2 different medications, 1 administered on each of the 2 study visits. And before each drug and after each drug, we completed a cardiac MRI. So for example, on visit 1, an individual would come have a cardiac MRI with 4D flow completed at rest, then they were administered sildenafil 50 milligrams by mouth. We waited an hour to allow for appropriate absorption and then repeated the exact same imaging sequence with cardiac MRI with 4D flow. They would come back later on a second visit and we would do the same thing with IV metoprolol with a targeted heart rate reduction to look at the effects of both RV right ventricular afterload reduction with sildenafil, followed by heart rate reduction with metoprolol. And the primary finding, positive finding from the study, is that we saw a significant improvement in right ventricular flow pattern and ejection of blood from the right ventricle, which led to higher right ventricular stroke volumes and ejection fraction after sildenafil in the preterm population. I mentioned we did 2 drugs, and so the second drug, metoprolol, actually resulted in reduction in heart rate, but also reduction in cardiac output as a result of the negative heart rate and inotropic effects of metoprolol.
And so, Kara, you mentioned in your paper that this provides very preliminary evidence. You call it a pilot study for potentially the chronic use of sildenafil. So do you have plans to follow up on this research with a chronic study? What do you think? Do you think it's promising as a long-term treatment?
I would love to do a study with more chronic dosing of sildenafil in the preterm heart. Whether this will ultimately be the best medication, I think we are a long ways away from knowing. But what I worry about in these individuals is that of the two chambers of the heart, the right side seems to be much more affected. We've seen that personally, and then multiple other studies have had similar publication experience, both from cardiac MRI and echo-based studies. The problem that I foresee with this is that there are not good medications to treat right-sided heart failure. All of the current classic heart failure medications, ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, medications that we know work for left-sided heart failure, have never been established as good right-sided heart failure medications. So we are limited in what sort of options we will have to treat, you know, what I think is likely to be more of a right-sided heart failure picture should it emerge.
This has been so interesting that we forgot something really important. The story behind the story. So in the intro, Kara mentioned that you had an encounter with a patient that kind of initiated your research pursuit. Do you mind telling us about that?
Sure, of course. As was mentioned, I was a MedPeds trained resident and was really fascinated by the neonatal ICU, so much so that I considered going into neonatology for a period. And then I decided ultimately that I really liked adult medicine even more and wanted to go into adult pulmonary and critical care. I really had no intention to pursue a career in research. I had done, I would say, not much above the bare minimum for exposure to research and things in research as a medical student and resident, because I really was not anticipating that sort of a career trajectory, honestly. And then when I was a first-year pulmonary and critical care fellow, I was asked to see a woman for an emergent pulmonary hypertension consult. And as I was talking to her, she mentioned that she was born at 32 weeks. She was 57 at the time. And she asked me, do you think my history of prematurity has anything to do with my development of pulmonary hypertension now? Well, in my back of my mind, I thought, I bet it does. But the best answer I could give her at the time was, I don't know. There really is no data. So as a result of that single patient encounter, I ultimately went back to a mentor and talked to him about how we could develop an animal model to study this. And that's how I actually initially got involved in animal models and into a wet lab looking at this, and ultimately moved to the University of Wisconsin to be able to do similar studies and cardiopulmonary physiology studies in humans who were born preterm. I really had no intention to pursue what I would consider now as a primarily research-focused career, but the reason I got more and more into it and have stayed is because the further I get into it, the more I'm convinced that there's a problem here. And I think there are very few people looking at this, both in the US and then also internationally. We have a fairly small group of us, even at an international level, that are really looking at these late cardiac outcomes in particular. And this is a huge population. In the US alone, I'd estimate that there are about 4 million people, children and adults, who were born moderately to extremely preterm or less than 32 weeks or so, that are at higher risk for long-term complications, except that we don't entirely know what those long-term complications are, much less know how to prevent them or how to treat them once they occur. So as much as, you know, I had intended to not pursue research and have a more clinically focused career, I realized that as a physician, if I really wanted to help people clinically, we were going to have to focus more on the research and really dive into this.
That's such a great story, Kara. I love that. And I love that patient of yours. who asked that question. I think that's also kudos to you for creating an environment where, you know, you're so easy to talk to. We can all ask our stupid questions, like me with the lungs for the fetus in utero. And yeah, I love that that's what drove you to this. I think we all have that one day where we read a paper or someone asked us a question, you go, huh, I don't know. And then you look at the literature and you realize nobody knows. And then thus a career is born. Love it.
Well, Kara, do you want to make a plug for anyone who's out there who's listening to this podcast who fits into this patient population or knows someone who fits into this patient population to reach out to you? Or are you still recruiting?
We are now recruiting. We have a new study that's open and recruiting now, but it's specifically focused on adults who were born and into this registry that we have at UT Southwestern. But I fully anticipate we will have additional studies in the future that we would recruit outside of that. In addition, I get calls and emails not infrequently from people around the country who are just trying to get some sort of framework and decide how to proceed with their own personal history of prematurity, where they should go, what they should do. Like I said, we have a heart-lung clinic at UT Southwestern for adults who are born preterm, which I run. So you would see me coming into that clinic. So I'm certainly happy to see anyone born preterm as a patient within that clinic. And then we also have an email address on our website. If you're interested in sort of what sort of research studies may be out there in the future, you can keep tabs on us and what we're doing through our website also.
So Kara, in your paper, I know you only had 9 participants in it, so you're underpowered to look at this, but did you look at whether there were any sex differences in your outcomes?
So with respect to the current study, I think it's just underpowered to look at sex-specific differences. However, that being said, there are likely a number of significant sex-related differences in the preterm population. I'll give you a couple of examples. In our animal studies and animal work, we have seen greater degrees of right ventricular dysfunction associated with more mitochondrial impairments and also skeletal mitochondrial impairments in male animals. We've also seen in our humans that the males tend to have lower power output, again, reflecting of lower skeletal muscle function relative to term control males. So there's a lot of suggestion that there's potential risk that's increased in males. The flip side of that is I think that there may be some adaptive features that are at play in the females that may still have long-term consequences. So we did a study in PBMC, so circulating lymphocyte cells from our individuals born preterm. When we looked at differences in mitochondrial function in PBMCs from individuals born preterm, the females had higher mitochondrial function than the males. None of them had known overt diabetes, but the females had a pattern that looked more like what we see, what has been published and reported in diabetics. Now, interestingly, there's some epidemiologic studies that suggest that females born preterm have a higher risk for diabetes than males who were born preterm. So there's a lot here. There's going to be a lot to unpack from a multi-organ system level, much more than we could potentially tackle as a single lab. But there definitely will be specific sex-related effects in this population.
So as I mentioned, my husband was premature, I think 31 weeks, and his dad was a cardiologist. So I think he was very strategic on how he raised him. So since he pretty much could walk, his dad put him in a lot of activities. So I think since he was 3, he started swimming and he did it for years and years. And maybe since he was 5, he started karate. And both swimming and karate are great cardiovascular exercises. So I just wonder if adults that had exercised heavily when they were developing as children, if that would make the outcomes different as adults?
That is an excellent question. And this gets really hard to unpack, but I think it's critical to understand the answer to. So it is something that we're already working on in various ways. So the single most consistent finding of the preterm heart is that it's smaller. Essentially, every study that has a significant finding, you know, statistically significant finding, this heart is always smaller than a term-born control heart when, you know, even when correcting for sex and height and sort of normal factors like that. We think that this is because preterm birth interrupts the normal heart development. So there are truly fewer cardiomyocytes, so heart cells within the heart after someone's born preterm. And if there's fewer cells overall, then this heart just simply doesn't grow to the same potential that it would otherwise. The key point here is what we don't know is whether this is modifiable. And the ways that it would be modifiable really is through exercise. We don't understand enough, I think, about how the heart grows in response to exercise in normal, healthy, term-born kids. So extrapolating that to the preterm heart is pretty difficult to do. But it's certainly possible that the hemodynamic changes during exercise, so the increase in cardiac output, the increase in heart rate, stroke volume, et cetera, may encourage this heart to grow and for the chambers to be larger than they might have been otherwise. It would be great to know if that's the case or not. Either way, I'm still gonna encourage people who have a former preemie to get their kids into exercise and activities like that, because there's really no downside that we can see. And even a kid that had significant, you know, NICU history and complications, for them to do, you know, age and symptom appropriate activity would be encouraged. So I think this is something that would be great if we knew the answer to. I think it's gonna take me a career to figure these sorts of things out, but we'll keep working on it.
You just made all the kinesiology researchers out there very happy with that question, Liz, and that answer, Kara. I'm the kinesiology researcher. Thank you, Liz, my co-host extraordinaire, for keeping us on track. And thank you, Kara, so much for the excellent conversation today and for your research program. This has been Behind the Bench for AGP Heart and Circ. See you next time.
Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.